dealing with, it's kind of hard to explain. If you're just reading it, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But once you understand the purpose behind the psalm, it makes a whole lot of sense in the way it's constructed and everything. But it was written by David, and it's thought that it would have been written some point after the Ark of the Covenant was moved from that holding place it was in for so long to an actual tabernacle. So that gives you kind of a general frame of reference in the Old Testament when the psalm was written. But it's only 9 verses. Beginning in verse 1, may the Lord answer you in the day of trouble. May the name of the God of Jacob set you securely on high. May he send you help from the sanctuary and support you from Zion. May he remember all your meal offerings and find your burnt offering acceptable. Selah. May he grant you your heart's desire and fulfill all your counsel. We will sing for joy over your victory, and in the name of our God we will set up our banners. May the Lord fulfill all your petitions. Now I know that the Lord saves his anointed. He will answer him from his holy heaven with the saving strength of his right hand. Some boast in chariots and some in horses, but we will boast in the name of the Lord our God. They have bowed down and fallen, but we have risen and stood upright. Save, O Lord, may the King answer us in the day we call. So, the context of this passage is a military encounter where Israel is getting ready to go out into battle, and the first 5 verses are recited by the people that are going into battle, or the people supporting those going into battle, or both. And as they're saying this, they are with one voice speaking basically to David and encouraging him and asking God to bless him and give him victory over their adversary. And then the second section, well, we'll look at the second section in just a minute. The first section is a prayer for the leaders, for those going out and leading them in battle. May the Lord answer you in the day of trouble. May the name of the God of Jacob set you securely on high. May he send you help from the sanctuary and support you from Zion. May he remember all your meal offerings and find your burnt offering acceptable. Now, that little word Selah, it's interesting. Basically, we have no idea what it means. But what is thought is that this was a song that was written and it was recited or sung. And this is kind of like a rest, a pause. So if you're thinking of a group of people that are gathered together and they're saying this as they're getting ready to go out into battle. What's the last thing before Selah? May you remember all your meal offerings and find your burnt offerings acceptable. Rest. Wouldn't it be a great time to do a sacrificial offering before they go out into battle?
Right.
So the thinking is that this Selah is a pause, a rest in the song, and at this point they would get to this and stop, and they would go through the ceremony of the sacrificing, asking God to bless their endeavors. Verse 4, may he grant your heart's desire and fulfill all your counsel. We will sing for joy over your victory. And in the name of our God, we will set up our banners. May the Lord fulfill all your petitions. So this is a prayer, an encouragement for David. But think about the pressure for purity that this puts on David. May he grant you your heart's desire. hopefully his desire is for God's glory and not for his own glory. Because we don't want a king of Israel who's just looking out for his own self-advancement. God has no reason to bless that. So they're basically saying, David, we trust you to have God's heart, because that's what David was called in his early years as king, was a man after God's own heart, and fulfill all your counsel. Then it says, we will sing for joy over your victory, and in the name of our God we will set up our banners. May the Lord fulfill all your petitions. So, interestingly, chapter 21 is the song that would be sung after a victorious battle. So they're talking about, we will sing for joy over your victory. There's a song that's got to come, and we're looking forward to singing that victory song when you come back from this battle victorious. Basically, they would go and they would, like a victory flag on the outpost of the battlefield, and like if they were taking a city or occupying a region, they would set up their flag. We've won. Next, well, I didn't change that. I want to change part of it. This is the prayer by the spiritual leaders. So we had, first of all, the prayer for the leaders. Now this section is the prayer for or by the spiritual leaders. Because in the first section we have that we are saying stuff. And then here we have now I know. So we have a change in speaker here. So what is thought is that that first section is recited by everyone and this section is recited by the high priest. Now I know that the Lord saves his anointed. He will answer him from his holy heaven with the saving strength of his right hand. Some boast in chariots and some in horses, but we will boast in the name of the Lord our God. They have bowed down and fallen, but we have risen and stood upright. Save, O Lord, may the king answer us in the day we call. So here the high priest is kind of blessing this endeavor. He's saying our trust is not in our military might. God's going before us. He is going to fight this battle, and the numbers are irrelevant. I mean, if you think of the battle that Gideon fought, there's like 200,000 soldiers in the army of the Amalekites, and well, there was more. That Gideon had gathered together a little army, and God said, all right, have them go down to the brook and drink.
Well, first off, did he ask them?
Yeah, if you want to go home,
get.
So a bunch of them left. And then he said, go, have them go down to the river and drink, and the ones that bring the water up to their mouth stay, and the ones that get down and drink from the water itself go home. That left him with 300 people. Against 200,000. So, was there any doubt why they won?
Yeah, it was not their own strength.
No, it was not their ability. It was God's superintending that situation. And that's what this high priest is doing. He's saying, you know, we don't trust in our chariots and our horses. We trust in God to fight this battle for us. So, the high priest is interceding on behalf of the army for victory over their enemies. Now, I think it's good for us to recognize what Israel had going for it. They had God in the sanctuary, the high priest interceding for them before God, but we have so much better deal.
Today.
well, we don't have to go to a high priest to get to God because we have Jesus Christ who is our high priest. He is the one who's doing that job, and he can do it better than any human. Yeah, we don't have to kill rams and goats and heifers and all that. That's good. But Hebrews 10:12-13 says, but he, having offered one sacrifice for sins for all time, sat down at the right hand of God, speaking of Jesus, waiting from that time until his enemies be made a footstool for his feet. So Christ is our high priest, and he has the ability to work out every battle for his will, for his glory. So I think that we have to avoid falling into the trap that Israel fell into, because you might remember they were fighting against the Philistines, and basically they were just, you know, we're going through this sacrifice stuff, but we're not really into it. We don't really want to do that. We're doing it because that's what we do. We're Israel. We're Jewish. We do this stuff, but whatever. And then they get into this military conflict, and the Philistines are getting ready to come wipe them out. So they know that God's not really interested in defending them, so that they have this great idea. We're going to take the Ark of the Covenant out of where it belongs, and we're going to put it in the front of the battle. So then God has to be on our side, because that's where God dwells. So they dragged the Ark of the Covenant out there, and they got whooped. Well, I would relate it to, like, in my own life, I just started to have to take blood pressure medicine. I wouldn't have to take blood pressure medicine if I would eat right, exercise, and get good sleep.
Yeah.
But it's a lot easier to take the stupid pill. And that's what Israel was doing. It's just easier to throw this thing out in front and say, okay, God, you got to take care of us now, because we got the holding your heart hostage. So basically, they're looking for a shortcut to victory. And we have to be careful that we don't fall into that trap, trying to look for a shortcut to spiritual maturity. Because you can't have God's favor outside of submitting yourself daily to his will. And we have this really bad habit of doing our own thing and then getting upset when God doesn't bless what we're doing for our own glory. What? No, God doesn't have any obligation to bless your mess. We have an obligation to seek his glory, to give him praise, to work, look for him, and to receive the credit and not ourselves. But he doesn't have any obligation to bless our efforts and our ideas and our egotistical goals. We can fall into that trap that Israel did very, very easily. So, recognizing that it's not the size of our bank account or our house or our vacations or anything else that makes us worthwhile, it's our identification and relationship with God himself that gives us worth. So, the thing that we focus on can be temporal or they can be eternal. And there are only two things that last forever: God's word and people. So where are our investments? Everything else is going to be burned up. Gone. Puff of smoke. Are we investing in those things that are gone like that? Or are we investing in those things